Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world, and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. If this is your first time, please make yourself comfortable as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, lasting health, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I am grateful to have met and worked with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, you all can do me a big favor. Please check out some of our past shows at answersforthefamily.com to hear some informative and entertaining guests, as well as some dynamic co-hosts as they discuss ways for you and your loved ones to become happier, healthier, and more at peace. Now, I'm also looking for some show ambassadors who will forward at least one of our shows to your social media group or someone that you know who can benefit from a particular subject. I want you to know that I truly appreciate it, and this is just another way that we, together, can make a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, I know that many people now, actually, they come up to me at the gym, and they make comments in regards to our ambassador to kindness, Gabriella Von Rey. And one of the questions I always get is, where is she? Well, normally I would start because she would be on and I would be saying, Gabriella, where in the world are you? Well, she is here in California, but unfortunately, with some of the weather issues and such, she is in an area that does not have internet. So she will not be joining us, but that does not mean that you cannot make a difference. So join the Dare to Be Kind movement. You can find it by going to the website, or you can find it on the Facebook page. And essentially what it is it's a place where you can go and you can talk to other people and see all the different ways in which people are making a difference. Now, in this day and age, when there seems to be so much focus on negativity, on divisiveness, on people wanting to spread a sort of a doom and gloom type of approach, this is just the opposite. This is a way to meet with people, like-minded people, who want to go out and dare to be kind. Meet someone that you've never met before. Offer just the most simple act of kindness, and watch how it grows in them and makes a difference. And as it does, people will continue to pay it forward. That's the way that we, the people, can make a difference, is by going out there and daring to be kind. So if you're driving, if you're not able to write this down, you can go to the Answers for the Family site, and we will have all the information on how you can connect with the Dare to Be Kind movement. Now, I'm happy to bring a topic today, and the title is also the title of our guest's new book, which is Your Heart, Your Hands, An Immigrant's Journey to Become One of America's Preeminent Cardiac Surgeons. Now, the book, My Heart, My Hands, is an encouraging, educational, and inspiring true story on how a boy from India overcame a difficult childhood and devastating hand injuries to become one of the most celebrated cardiac surgeons in U.S. history. Now, our guest is Dr. Aram Singh, who has personally performed over 15,000 heart surgeries. Now, Dr. Singh has earned numerous awards as a physician, including the American Heart Association's Hero at Heart Award and the Milton Homolsky Outstanding Physician Award. Now, in practice at Rhode Island Hospital, he's been there since 1975, and Dr. Singh has been voted the top doc by Rhode Island Monthly Magazine for the last 16 years. Now, he has also He's been elected to the Rhode Island Heritage Hall of Fame, of which he is only the second person of East Indian descent to receive this distinction. So with that, we'd love to hear from him. So Dr. Singh, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much for having me, Alan.
Well, it is my pleasure. And it is interesting that we would be on this subject. I recently, and just within the last 18 months or so, a friend of mine and I went to the same physician and said, you know, we want to get a complete workup. And they checked everything that they could on us. And one of the things that a test that I wasn't aware of was a heart pressure test. And they immediately, with my friend, said, we need to get you in for more work immediately in regards to your heart. And I'm told by some of the doctors that were involved is that had that not been done, it's very possible that, they said he may not be with us anymore, or that he probably would have had to go in for heart surgery if they could not make certain corrections at the time in which they did. And he's changed his entire lifestyle. And over the last 18 months, he's gotten much better. So it was a great thing. And what I found was I learned so much more about all of the things that can be done with our hearts. So when my producer said we had a chance to get you on the show, I was very happy. So I really want to thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me. One of the things, we live in a time and period that all of these tests are available. Think about our people, parents and grandparents, who did not have the facility or the ability, are having all of these tests. So the science and technology has done a tremendous amount work and has benefited the humanity. And you can think about in the future is really unlimited. The way we're exploring it, the way we're doing it, is always changing. So it's a very exciting time. It's always been an exciting time. But this book is, which you wrote about it, Your Heart, My Hand. This book is not about the medicine. It is about my career. This is about my journey, how patient impacted my heart and how I impacted there, and what is the state of healthcare now.
Well,
that's the book about.
Yes, it really is. And that was one of the things that I loved about it, because there are some books that are written and it seems, you know, it seems very educational, which is, I think is great if that's our goal. But again, the beauty of this was that I felt that it wasn't just educational, but it was inspiring. It was emotional. And those are the things that I think make for a really good read. So in fact, what I'd like you to do, if you could, is tell us a little bit about your background and start with your childhood in India, because I think that's part of the story that is so engrossing
to
me.
Thank you. I'm glad you asked me. First of all, as you know, in the book, as you mentioned, a childhood in India, I was born in India. I came in this country as a legal immigrant, and now I'm an American citizen by choice. As a kid, I had a rebellious temperament. I was quite active. You would call, if you grow up in this country at this time, you will be called a juvenile delinquent, or you will be called in as a full of it, a piece of work. I was very active. I was always involved in doing things and looking firsthand and get, so always in trouble. And if I wasn't in trouble, the trouble will get me. So I was born in a small town in India, near northeast, close to Nepal, and this is in the 40s, late 40s. I was born in 44. So there were not many facilities. My dad was a headmaster. We had three brothers and sister. And one afternoon, when I was 6.5 years old, I decided to escape on my backyard, which was full of mangoes and guava trees. I decided to fetch a fully ripe guava on the top of the tree, which was about 10, 12 feet high. The backyard was rocky, and I climbed up to the all the way top. As soon as I was ready to fetch the guava, suddenly a white-faced, dark, prang like a teeth hanging out monkey right on my face.
Wow.
He wanted to have the go. I was leaping rapidly, got there. He raised his hand. I raised my hand. When I saw his face, I got scared. I was only 6.5 years old. Next thing I did, I got so scared, I let my hand holding the branch let go. I landed in the rock. And next thing I had a skull fracture, completely lacerated in my scalp, and it completely dismantled my right elbow. My right elbow was broken. I was unconscious. My brother came in, notified my parents. I was taken to a dispensary. There was no hospital. My injury was very severe. I had a head injury. I was unconscious, but later on became when I recovered, I realized I had no movements in my hand. My hand was completely dismantled, the elbow, and the doctor, who was a local doctor, practitioner, put it together. He said, I have to go to a bigger and better place.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents took me next morning to 150 miles away to my grandfather's house, where was some better facility was available. And my maternal grandfather was a physician, so he knew something. And to make the story short, I had 3 years of completely paralyzed right hand. I was not able to pick my piece of paper or held a pencil to do anything. My hand was dismantled, deformed, and I had already had a four procedure. By that time, I grew up in India where poverty was, you could see people all around the street. There was no clear clean water. I drank polluted water. I walked in polluted water. I had saw the kids' neighbors who I played with die very young age. I saw animals fighting for the street food. I had every disease I could think of except leprosy or TB. I had malaria, typhoid, hepatitis, chickenpox, smallpox, hookworm, tapeworm, name it, in every disease. After four procedure, I had a very bad case of hepatitis, liver was failing, and a bad pneumonia. The doctor said, no more I could do anything for you. You already had 3 years of extensive procedures done. You cannot have any more anesthesia, and it's beyond the repairable. At that point in time, my hand was crooked, and I could not extend my hand, only has it bend at a 90 degree. So when I visited my doctors, my dad was there, and when the doctor said, nothing we can do for you, we'll leave your hand the way it is, at least you can feed yourself. My dad got really upset. My mom was there. I remember the scene very well. Dad first started screaming to the doctor. He said, you mean to say that our eldest son is going to live with a hand like that and he will be beggar on the street? When the word beggar came out, I knew what the beggars look like in India. They're standing on the side, missing body limbs, broken pan, looking for food in a coin. I started crying. I said, my life is coming to be like that. I could not be consoled. I realized what was. At that point in time, my mom, as most mothers do, first she yelled at my dad. She said, by yelling and screaming, he's not going to get better. Next thing, she held me tight, picked me up. She said, get up, look up, and don't give up. I'm going to work with you. She installed a positive attitude to me at that day. I never forgot that. And she made the decision, even the doctor said, we cannot give any more anesthesia. We can leave the hand alone the way it is. Mom said, no, you have to take him. They said, you can't have anesthesia. They said, whatever it takes, if you know anesthesia, but I still want you to give one more try. So the next time, the doctor next morning took me up because persisted my mom. I was fully awake, three strong eyes. Two sat on my feet, one on my chest. My doctor grabbed my hand, gave a signal to these guys, like you see on the hanging, and he grabbed my hand and twisted it and broke it like a bamboo stick. I heard the noise and the pain. I must have cried. You could hear my voice all the way 500 miles to Taj Mahal. The entire campus was roaring. Anyway, there was no air conditioning. There was no TV. There was no elastic band, yellow band. And so what do you do? And doctor said, well, I need the rehab. And mom worked with my doctor. She designed it. So he did the same purpose. She put the bricks in the bag, and she tied my hand with the brick. And I will drag the brick like it. I will stagger on the street every morning and evening, carrying a bag of brick on my back like inmates of a penal colony. Kids will look at that. I lost my childhood. I did not have any childhood for 3 years. At that point in time, slowly, slowly, my hand got stretched. It did the same job. When you do here, you lift 5 pound weight. It does is a passive resistance. And when you stimulate that thing, your muscle develop. Instead of a 5 pound weight, I was doing a 5 pound break. I carried the 3-4 break. Later on, my grips were not that great. I went, she will pick me up and take the window. And back home in India, the window had a crossbar, so the intruder couldn't come. I'll grab the window, she let it go, she will stand there. I was hanging down like a bat. People will go pass by, see it, laugh. They will say, gee, he must have done bad thing. It's a nice way to penalize this kid. So I went through a lot of those. Finally, my hand got better. I start picking up pencil. During the whole time, my mom had only, this is in India, a small village, 10th grade education. She taught me everything she knew me, everything she knew. She taught me math, English, literature, anything. But she tutored me, and then I was almost ready to go next year after 3 years to school. And when I got tested, I had missed all the elementary school. I missed middle school. I was ready to go. I was tested pretty good for eighth grade. But there was no seats there. The high school was already filled. So I had to wait another year because the public school, there was no seat. So I said, okay. And I was frustrated because I saw every kid going there, going to school, playing it. And here I was sitting, I had nothing to do. I was curious, I was anxious, I was rambunctious, I was rebellious, and I started doing things which I shouldn't have done it. I started hopping the trains, I prowled these markets, I squalled the back alleys, I did every of those things. I walked around Indian Artful Dodger. I took a pride to call me as a bad kid. I did not pickpocket, but I was definitely, I acted like a fictional Dodger of Dickens' Oliver Twist. Mm-hmm. So I did all of those things. Finally, I got involved, saw the kite runner, kite flying. Mm-hmm. You all must have read the book Kite Runner. The Kite Runner was a great book. This is kite flying is a very competitive sport in India and in South Asia. What that means is that what it really basically means is it's a beautiful sport, but ruthless, heartless. What basically means is the single kite aloft in the sky is a challenge to a neighbor, bring it on. And the basis of this thing, when you fly a kite, is to, when you're flying in a competition, shack all the kites in the line and plummet it to the ground, and you want to be the only one. And I became a very good kite flyer in a very short period of time, in 6 months. And then I was in a junior competition. I didn't have a school. I was doing all of these things. So I was planning the competition. I was moving along. I was semifinal. One evening, I positioned myself a little bit hill, just like a baseball. If you get a little bit on the baseball mound, you have better leverage to pitch down. Mm-hmm. Same thing, kite. If you have a little higher place, it's better to have a traction to pull it. So I positioned myself on a in the front of a ditch, but there was a higher area on a pole, and we were flying the competition, and suddenly a black kite came in underneath. So a kid in the neighborhood said, "Watch it, they're going to cut your kite." I saw that, and I completely forgot the surrounding I was standing on. I pulled myself backward. Next thing, I was in the ditches. My kite was gone, and I broke my left hand this time. And so I had to go through again, and this time when the neighbor's kid went there to my home to tell my dad that I'm in a ditch, broken hand, my dad says, "Leave him there." His behavior, he was very upset. He says, "You besmirched the family name. You brought the discourage. You brought the, he was dishonor the name, and you ruined your career. Nothing we can do." And a few hours later, my mom came, picked me up, took me to the hospital, got it done. And eventually, after 4 or 5 years of missing school, I straightened myself and got into high school, graduated. I was not a very good student. I was an average student because I never concentrated. It's not that I couldn't do it. I was missing my childhood. I wanted to play. And then I got into college. I had some bad company, bad friends. But again, when I studied, I did okay in graduate college. And eventually got into medical school to everybody's surprise.
Well, you know,
once I got into medical school, I was one day after, and I had a very difficult time in medical school. Suddenly, because I never paid attention to studying, I had to deal with anatomy, physiology, pathology, and I was difficult to comprehend. At that point in time, we didn't have the diagnosis. I'm severely dyslexic. But I had one advantage. I had insomnia. So I would study 3-4 times, memorize the thing. And I was the bottom of the class. There was 110 students. I would say I was at 100th ranking. One day I was going to home after the end of the first year. I ran into my uncle on a train station. He said, "I'm glad to see you." When he saw me and put a hand, I said, "Why are you glad to see me? I'm going home." He said, "Your dad had a massive stroke. He may not survive." I couldn't believe it. I was only 17 years old. I had to go home straight to the hospital. I saw in a, you know, hospital is not like here. A small room, 40 by 40, 30 patients. Dogs are running on the floor, people on the floor, the fans are barely moving. Mom was fanning my dad to keep the flies out. Dad unconscious. The room was smelling like a putrid hot day. I couldn't believe it. I was devastated. I saw that tears in my mom, and mom was scared because we don't have the, like we have here in this country. We have to take it granted, a Medicare, disability, welfare, none of those. If you don't work, if you don't have a hand, if you can't make a living, you have some money saving, you run away. There's no retirement plan. Mm-hmm. Family help up for a short period of time. And gradually what happened, the money ran out. A few weeks later, my mom said to me, I was devastated, and I saw a tear in her eyes. She looked in my eyes, and I saw a pain in her eyes because she was afraid. How is he going to feed us? How is he going to take care of him? She had no job. She can't get the job. She's not educated. There's no job there. So she became a maid. She became a servant. She became a she was a mother. She was a housewife. She was a nurse. She became everything. At that point in time, I saw the pain and anguish in my mom's. She says.
Now, so was that the time in which you decided that you were now going to shift to becoming the person?
That's right, sir. That's Alan. Absolutely. That's the when my mom looked in my eyes and said, "Aaron," she called me Babel. She said, that's my nickname, Babel. She says, "I want you to grow up. I want you to go back, study. You are the guardian of the family. I don't know your dad is ever going to be." I was 17 and a half here. She gave me all the responsibility. That day I took my kids, my brothers, I call them the kids, one on the pedal, them on the front, one on the back of the bikes. 100-degree temperature, Pell Elementary School, every day in the summer vacation. I didn't go back to school for summer. Help my mom to help his dad. And once the summer was over, except I was doing a labor work like a slum in the, rickshaw guys in India. And that's the way I was. And bare feet running in a 100-degree temperature. I was taking my brothers to schools. And then I went back to school. When I went back to medical school, I gave up everything. I said, better study. I graduated in 4 years in the second in class. I could have graduated first in class. When I graduated, I had the opportunity to stay there, but I decided to come to the great country, America, because two reasons. Because I wanted to be trained as a doctor, number one, and during the training in this country, you get paid, and especially in the dollars, and dollar has a lot of exchange rate, so I could send my money to my family. And the only place I got the job, two places, New Jersey and Massachusetts, Worcester, mm-hmm. in Worcester City. So they gave me plane fare, and they promised me a room and board. So when I had $8 in my pocket when I left, although the hospital, when I was ready to leave, nagged about it, about the payment of my passage for the airplane. But I was able to manage it later on from my family. My grandparents gave me borrowed, so I was late, but that was the loan money. And you will read this in the book. You know, mm-hmm. I'll encourage this to, it's a human book to read people. It's a full account of many great stories in the book. And so my grandfather lent me money, and I came in this country with $8 left there. $3 I spent in London for a bus ride from the airport to the hotel. That was the first time I ever saw a television, laid my hand on television in 1967. Black and white box with the two antenna. And it took a 30-hour flight. I took the cheapest flight to get back to Worcester. When I arrived in Worcester, I had $5 in my pocket. That was the most valuable money I ever held, Mr. Lincoln. And I kept in the pocket. I didn't have a billfold, so I had in the pocket. And I'll tell you, Alan, every 2 minutes I'll put my hand in the pocket, make sure Mr. Lincoln does not escape.
But, well, okay. Well,
so here, when I arrived...
Okay, well, hold on. Before we go into that, we're going to take a break. But I want everybody to understand that you know, besides the fact that it's obviously it's a very inspiring story, it is also what I got out of the book was it is also a time of gratitude that so much of what you talk about in the book is how grateful you are, even though you went through some things that most Americans can't imagine going through that tough of a situation, and yet you not only fought through that, but you talk very much about how grateful you are now for your mother and for all of the people that helped you through this. So I want everybody to continue. Stay with us. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that is legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking with Dr. Aram Singh, and we're talking about his journey starting as a boy in India and going through things that most of us would be just unimaginable, and then coming to this country as an immigrant and making decisions that eventually brought him to a point in which he became one of the most preeminent surgeons in the United States. So with that, I want to ask a couple of questions or comments because we also have some of our listeners who, by the way, I want you to know that I want everybody to know we really appreciate the questions that people send in. I realize that many people work in the middle of the day. We get some people who acknowledge that they are teachers or whatever profession that they are in, but they want to ask these questions, and they tell us, well, you know, we've subscribed on iTunes, so we're going to listen to the answer later. If you can please make sure and ask this question or make this comment. So one of them is, this one reads, I have several elderly family members who had both had both heart and cancer illnesses during their 70s and 80s. They always shared that their doctors were caring and compassionate. In the last 10 years, when visiting with friends and family who have similar conditions, the vast majority tell me that they feel as though they are pushed through their appointments and that the treatments as if they were nothing more than a name on a list. Do you think the state of our HMOs and such and the other medical systems has deteriorated dramatically? And this is from Greg in Alabama.
Well, you know, in every system has some issues and a problem. Is our healthcare is perfect? The answer is no. But still, the American healthcare is the best in the world. I personally have witnessed, if you read in my book, three places of healthcare. I worked in India, went to medical school. I went in London, UK, where I spent a year and a half there. And I practiced mostly in America. Plus, I also did some work in Canada. So all of these places have seen what is their healthcare. 80% of the people have the best care we can get it. The problem is 20%. The 20%, we have resources. We have the, as I said, the healthcare is big enough for everyone and best enough for everyone. But its healthcare is not big enough for everybody greed. Everybody's greed. The greed is the one kills us. If we are less greedy, and I can tell you everything, from the corporation to the pharmacies to the CEOs to the doctors to the lab, everybody is greed. And the greed is the problem. As far as the gentleman is asking the question about the compassion, you know, we can only teach the people, be compassionate, be human, and each individual are different, how people react and how they do it. My own teaching is each life matters, regardless of age, sex, race, religion. Every life is precious. And I practice and I taught. I've been teaching at the Brown Medical Schools, and I teach at the Bryan, and I run after I retire at a free clinic. And I tell you, the patients in the free clinic where I work, I can assure you, get better care than the patients who are getting into a private clinic. I can tell you, because the doctors we have here, and there are doctors who are not compassionate. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. You know, there are people everywhere in every field.
Right. So, Dr. Singh, I like to give myself a magic wand from time to time. So with this magic wand, I am making you Surgeon General, and I am asking you as your first duty to change the healthcare system in the United States for the better. What's the first thing that you do?
I think we ought to have, number one, you know, the humanity. We are not there to judge. We have to set some standards. We have to understand why people come to, you became a doctor. Why people become a priest? Because calling. Why you become a doctor? Not to make money. You obviously, everybody wants to live. You want to be to provide the service. And it provides, I think we need to change, you know, there are so many brilliant people in the United States, in Washington. They have been working for 30 years or 40 years, hasn't been able to do. The whole, when Medicare came up, you know, Truman tried it. It didn't happen. Before the Roosevelt tried it, nothing happened. Finally, Johnson able to do it. So I think we have brilliant people. They will, if your mind put together, but we have to understand why we people going sick, what we need to provide. It's the humanity. It's a job to provide the health care, to provide the service to the elderly and the sick people. You know, until we change the culture, as I say, the greed and selfishness, it's not going to happen. You can keep pouring money. You keep more money, people are going to steal more.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. So one of the things that you mentioned a little bit has to do with technology. So, and I think you mentioned it in the book, but in your opinion, how has technology such as advanced robotics changed heart surgery for the better?
Well, you know, I was fortunate, Alan, to be in the field where I saw from the 70s, 60s to till about 2 years ago when I retired, is that the saw the evolution of the heart surgery. Heart surgery was not popular at all in the 60s. You know, there wasn't done very few, only transplant here and there, experiment. Over the years, the heart surgery where you had a big cut, big incision, you know, that doesn't mean that people didn't do well. The recovery was much longer, you know, and the disability was very long after the operation. People now with the robotics and a minimal invasive that you can do these, what we did as a surgeon, a big cutting with a lesser invasion, just a little small incision. Think about it. Most patients 20 years ago, 30 years ago, had a bypass surgery. Now the bypass surgery is done, it's still done, but it's less because stent is put in there. Same thing. Everybody who had a valve operation, had a chest open, have an artificial valve put in, or a pig valve, a cow valve, with a bigger operation. Now you can do 80% of those patients with a smaller cut in the groin or the arm, and put a valve, and they were able to be active and doing things in 2 or 3 days. Think about the whole field of cardiology and cardiac surgery, the teamwork. You know, the prevention is also important. People are more aware of smoking. People have high blood pressure control, diabetes, cholesterol. That has cut down the coronary disease. We still have a lot to be. Obesity is a big problem. We still have the education. But it's getting better. It's getting better. Every generation is getting better. Well, you know, that doesn't mean that everybody is cured. Their poverty is one of the main reasons. People are poor. And when the people are poor, we have a choice to take, buy a pill or have a food. They get the food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the choice.
Well, you just touched on an area which I was just going to head to, has to do with prevention. Again, we have lots of families that listen. We have, you know, parents that are out there looking for advice as to what they can do with their children. What would you tell parents that's the best thing they can do now as far as habits they can give their children to at least stack the odds in their favor to where they're going to have a healthier heart for a longer period of time?
Well, the one thing they cannot help, nobody can help, your gene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a very bad family history, nothing you can do. You have to have some medical therapy. But I think one of the things which we should do as a encourage as a family is the civility and humanity. Besides that, we have to tell the family, look, smoking is a dangerous and a bad, not only for heart disease, lung cancer, and every other aspect. Smoking, no. Same thing, anything excessive, exercise a good thing, walk healthy. Well, these things don't cost.
Right.
Cigarettes are very expensive. You know, I don't know, probably $6, $8 a packet. I don't buy it. I never smoke, you know. So cigarettes are smoking. Same as the wine and the drinking and all other things. These are expensive. You could drink a water. I said healthy eating, exercise, no smoking. And obviously, if you do those things, a lot of problems will resolve, like high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. You know, some of these are acquired disease. You know, these are because we eat, indulge ourselves to the wrong food all the time. And one of the basic problems, Alan, is a lot of poverty. You know, you can go buy, you know, and I see it, and I've done it myself. When I started in this country, I personally did. But I was fortunate able to get out of that. You know, if I can go $10 and buy a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken, I can feed my entire family for overnight, you know, or McDonald's. You know, and if you go and buy healthy food, it's not going to be $10. It's going to be more, and you'll be hungry.
Well, and
you know,
well, and I completely agree. And that's, in fact, one of the things that you know, that I've discussed. And I was interviewed for a documentary in regards to homelessness, and you know, they were talking about what are some of the things. And they were talking to me more from the standpoint of an investigator and dealing with human trafficking and the connection to homelessness. But I talked a little bit about what you just said in regards to food. Is, you know, we're making it, you know, inexpensive to eat stuff that's not good for you. And if we're going to, as a government, if we're going to try to change this, that if we start setting up to where we supplement things, you know, with the good foods and the things that are good for you, you know, if we have the tax dollars go to that, we're going to save money on the other end because of the fact that we're going to have less diabetes, less you know, various types of illness and disease. We're going to save money. Exactly. And
yeah,
and
but,
save
but the
lives.
Problem is, but the food industry controls a lot of legislators.
There you
if
go.
If you look at watch the television, you see every 5 minutes, you see a food commercial, either a drink, a soda, or some kind of meat, some kind of it's all constant there. And if you look at the packaging, they're not great. But anyway, so the commercializing it, the marketing it is a big business. So I the bottom line comes in is the poor people, the poverty is a big issue. They can't get their healthy food, and the greed is a big problem.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
You know, it's a serious problem. But anyway, this book is, as I said, Alan, it's Your Heart, My Hand. It's published by the Hachette. You know, you can get it at the Amazon or Barnes Books and the Barnes and Noble, and it is a human story. And I would encourage people to read it because I talk in the details. It's not only my journey, and we all facing all the time now with the no offense to Mr. President, but the dehumanization and with people, here I came, but I felt everything, even in the 60s. So you know, I felt discrimination, disappointment, discouragement, racism, name it, everything I faced when I was growing up in this country. I met the lovely wife here, a woman in New York, and I had to tell you, I was very lucky and fortunate, just like my mom. She pulled me out of my darkest day. And one other thing I will encourage to listeners, the story besides my disability, my paralyzing hand and dyslexia and all of these things, I had one very strong, and I said in the beginning, my mom gave me a very strong positive attitude. And similarly, I was fortunate to meet a woman, my wife, who's been my wife for 49 years. She pulled me out of darkness. She kept me focused and a positive. We ignore all negativity. You know, people made the racial comments. People made all kind of things to me. But it didn't bother me. It hurt me. It did hurt. You know, if somebody say it didn't hurt you, no, it did. But I felt bad for them. I said, they're ignorant. Mm-hmm. I was focused. I was determined. So the moral of the story is, if you determine, you focus, you perseverance, you will over, and if you have a grit, you will overcome most discouraging obstacle.
That's
and I
perfect.
Did.
You know,
you know, I was able to do with paralyzed hand. I practiced every night for an hour, instead of going to theaters, sewing pillows and getting mobilities. And I was able to do more than touch 15,000 hearts in the from 1 day old baby to 99 year old.
Right.
And some of these patients, Alan, in the story I write about, how they impacted my heart, how they impacted, I impacted theirs. How do you do, how you treat human aspect? And a 25-year-old girl who's pregnant and needs a heart operation. Does she need, the doctor said, you have to have an abortion before a surgery. Does he have a right? Does we have enough knowledge to say? We talk about what we do with the people who are veteran, good citizen of this country, went to fought for the United States in Afghan, in Iraq, comes back with hepatitis and AIDS, and needs a heart operation. What do you do? Immigrant come in who is in heart for the desperate need of a surgery. You say, no money. Would you provide the service? What do you do with a 90-year-old man? You say, well, he's not going to live too long. Do you do take care of him? Or you do treat him as a human being? Or you say, well, he's too old, let him go. What do you do with a 40-year-old guy who is the average worker, who has two kids, he's a mechanic, he doesn't have enough money, you know, he can't take enough pills, you do a surgery, what is his life is going to be like, what is the quality? So I talk about all of these things, not about the surgery, about the human aspect. What about the people who sue each other, you know?
Right.
So what is the emotion?
Well, and that's...
So I would encourage the people to read the book. I really do.
Well, and I do as well, and that was one of the points I was going to bring up in regards to the book. And we've only got about 2 minutes left, but I know that you talk about lessons that patients have taught you that, you know, after 15,000, you know, heart surgeries that you've done, and again, we don't have a lot of time, so what would you say that your favorite or number one lesson that a patient taught you?
Well, one thing, patient, they are in the pain. They are needing and desperate. You better listen to them. Don't treat them as a robot and don't make a prejudgment. Why? Don't make a decision why this patient is a welfare, why this patient is an immigrant, why he came illegal, why this patient is doesn't have the money or using it. Don't make a judgment. Make a decision. Listen to them. That would be, and be human.
Okay.
Be empathic.
Yeah, and that's great. And let me add, we have another comment that is coming in from a listener. This one reads, I too am an immigrant, originally from Indonesia. My first few years in the United States was difficult, perfecting my English skills, navigating my way through the university, and then securing a position as an economics professor. I feel so grateful to have had the support of my family and my many friends that I have made along the way. I want you to know that I have purchased your book, and I am sharing your story with others in my family who sometimes feel the adjustments a little bit too overwhelming. They need this encouragement and not to give up. Thank you for writing this book. And this is from, I believe it's pronounced Putra, from Los Angeles.
Thank you very much for writing a beautiful comment. To the people who are listening today, the message is, work hard, don't give up, you will succeed despite discouraging obstacles. And don't think about when you send up to America. America is the top of the hill. You work hard. There's nowhere in the world is like America.
Dr. Singh, thank you so much for that. That's a great way for us to end the show. I really just want to take this time to acknowledge you and thank you for your hard work, for everything that you've gone through. You know, you've saved thousands and thousands of lives, and you're now giving back by putting your story in this book. I hope that many people will read it. And again, you know, it's called Your Heart, My Hands. You can also go to the website, yourheartmyhands.com.
Your Heart, My Hands is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere you want. And I would encourage you to read. It's a human story. You're going to love it.
Exactly.
And thank you for having me, Alan. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we will be discussing the promise of wholeness, cultivating inner peace, mindfulness, and love in a divided world. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Spreaker, and they'll send the show directly to your phone or to your computer. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us reach more people, and we greatly appreciate it. The next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us, continue to spread the word, and do something kind today. Be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.